evening and welcome to the 427th episode of Travelwits Radio. I'm your host, Dan Schlossberg, along with my friend and co-host, Mary Ellen Nugent-Lee, and this is the 10th season of Travelwits Radio, the show that lets you enjoy the pleasures of travel from the comfort of your armchair.
Every week at this time, we talk to people representing destinations, hotels, airlines, railroads, car rental companies, and others in the world of travel and hospitality, from authors and bloggers to broadcasters and publicists. If it's got anything to do with travel, it's got everything to do with Travel Itch Radio.
And our honored guest tonight is my longtime friend, Chris Lucas, author, actor, tour guide, and Disney expert. Welcome, Chris, to Travel Itch Radio.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
Chris, you're an actor who does a terrific one-man show in which you portray the life of Walt Disney. How did you become involved with Disney, and how has your connection grown over the years?
Like everybody else, I became a fan of Disney in childhood, watching his shows, going to the movies, and it just became something that evolved into a passion. Like, people have a passion for different things, and Disney became mine. And I went, and 2001 was approaching, would have been Walt's 100th birthday, and I realized, just from talking to a lot of people, that people thought by that time that the name Walt Disney was just a corporate name, like Betty Crocker or something else that was just made up and thrown in there. A lot of people didn't realize he was a real person with a full life and a full history. So the light went off as an actor and Disney fan to start creating a show. And from that, I reached out to a lot of people at Disney and the Disney Archives guy and a lot of different people and made so many connections that it just, from 2001 until now, 20 years, it's turned into what's become, you know, sort of a sideline job almost, aside from the acting, to be involved as a Disney. I never say the word expert because I don't believe there's anybody that's a true expert in anything, but aficionado, historian, you know, any other word you want to use.
Well, everybody knows about Disneyland and Disney World, but there are many other Disney sites around the country. Your new book, Top Disney, deals with those. Please share.
Sure. Like you say, a lot of people, when you say Disney to most people, the first thing they think of is the parks. And, of course, the company is so much more than that. But as far as Walt specifically, if someone is a fan of Disney, there are places in all parts of the country they can go to discover more about him and what led to. It's part of what my book Top Disney is. It's a list of top 10 lists, 100 of them, but they sort of connect the dots. I start with Walt and his influences, and it leads to, then you go, oh, I see why the parks look like this, why his movies are like this, because it's all about his philosophy. And the way to see that is if you go to different places like where he grew up and where he lives. So that's part of what's in the book, is the top 10 Disney places that you can go that aren't the parks.
And so how did you decide to write it, and what kind of cooperation did you get from the Disney people?
I got an incredible amount of cooperation from Disney. The first thing, as any author knows, when you want to write a book and you want to hopefully sell some books, the first question you have to ask is there an audience for it? And with Disney, thank goodness, there is. And then the second question is, what can I say that nobody else has said before? What can I write about that people, you know, in any subject, if you're writing about baseball or Disney, you can't keep repeating the same thing, or people will say, well, I've read that book already. So that was my goal, to find a way to talk about Disney in a way that nobody had before. So I reached out to a man named Dave Smith, who 50 years ago created the Disney Archive. Studios used to just throw stuff away. If you've ever read, like, MGM sold all the props and costumes or tossed them in the garbage. So he was at Disney, luckily, when they were getting rid of everything, and he said, stop, don't do that. And he was trained in library resources and as an historian, so he created an archive, and they have this amazing, they have everything Walt ever wrote, every memo, every note, every folder. And so I reached out to him to find out if anybody had ever done a top 10 list, and he called me right away and said, no, nobody has. So he invited me out there, and we many trips back and forth and many conversations, and he was incredibly helpful, and he got the Disney company behind me in the effort. So that helped a lot.
That is so cool. Can you tell us more about the book? Now, you teased us with the list. How many chapters are in it, and how many sites do you cover?
That's a good question about chapters, because I break it down into lists about Walt himself. So there's probably about 10 different lists there about, you know, the 10 influences on Walt, the 10 greatest books about Walt, things like that. And then it goes into the company, and a couple of lists about the company, about people that have worked for them. And then the third one is about the actors and the artists. And then the last part of the book is, you know, what you would expect in a top 10 list about the top 10 princesses, top 10 short films and things like that. But and the way I did it, because I tried to be fair, they're all listed alphabetically. So, you know, I didn't want to say, because there's no way to say, oh, Mary Poppins is the greatest movie. You can't do that because everybody's got their favorite. So I listed the 10. And it wasn't just my choice. You know, if I had my choice, I would list Robin Hood, which is a sentimental favorite, as the greatest Disney animated movie of all time. But almost nobody would agree with me on that. So I did a consensus of Disney fans and from Facebook groups and all, and kind of try to figure out what are the 10 in each category that most people would list. And it was hard, many times, especially with the parks and things like that. But I was able to get it down to 10 in each of them and listed them in the fairest way I could.
Chris, you just returned from a Midwestern road trip to promote the book. Where did you go, and did you consider the trip a success?
Oh, it was a great success. We went to 10 different states in 10 days. So the topic of the trip was how the Heartland gave Disney its heart, and it was all about the fact that Walt grew up. He was born in Chicago. He grew up in Missouri, and that was the area that he lived in. So, you know, today when you think of Disney, the vision he was trying to sell to America, anybody that goes to a Disney park, is not the cities, it's not New York, it's not Chicago, it's not San Francisco or L.A., it's the Heartland. When you go into a Disney park, when you're walking down Main Street or you go into Frontierland, they're trying to sell you that version of 1900s, you know, small-town America, what we think of from The Music Man and all those other classic musicals. And so that was because he grew up around there. So part of the trip was visiting some of the places that I'm going to mention with my top 10 places you can go.
We're talking with Disney historian and author Chris Lucas.
Chris, how did Disney's humble beginnings influences work?
Well, that's a very good question. So Walt was born in a little house in Chicago, and that's one of the places you can go visit. The house is there in Chicago that his father built. It's still standing. His father, Elias, was a carpenter and a contractor, and he built that house. And Walt was born in 1901, but then Chicago started growing, and more crime was coming into the city, and organized crime. So his father got scared and moved the family to a farm in a little town called Marceline, which is way up at the top of Missouri. It's about 2 or 3 hours from Kansas City or St. Louis. But that town, if you go there and you're a Walt fan, you'll understand completely how he became who he was. And he himself said in every interview he ever did for the rest of his life, he only lived there for 5 or 6 years on this little farm with a barn and everything, but that influenced the way he saw America and the world and everything else was from living in that small town. So their Main Street, if you walk down, it's exactly what you see when you walk into a Disney. He had his artists go there and look at it and copy it perfectly. And the barn is still there that he grew up in. You can actually go to the barn and sign your name on the wall. They allow people to take markers and write your name there. And they took an old train station, because Walt was obsessed with trains, and they turned it into the Walt Disney Hometown Museum. And I've been to a lot of places to talk about Disney, including the parks, and this is by far the best place of them all to go to. And again, it's a small town, it's out of the way, but Marceline, Missouri, that museum, top shelf, and they have authentic stuff, like the little desk that Walt, when he was a boy, carved his initials into a school desk, and they still have that. They have the rocking chair from his house. They have all these wonderful things that you could see what it was like. But it's from there that you can see how, to answer your question, how he became who he became and what made him, what drove him to the vision of eventually Disneyland and Walt Disney World.
Oh, so where and how did you research Walt Disney's life? I mean, it sounds like you've been doing this a long time.
That's a good question. I went to, like I said, Chicago and to Marceline, and then Kansas City was another city that there are a couple of places. There's an organization called Thank You Walt Disney, because Walt, when he was older, he wanted to fight in World War I. He was too young, so he joined the Red Cross Ambulance Corps, and some of the people that were in it with him were Ernest Hemingway and Ray Kroc from McDonald's, and they were all too young to fight, but they went off there, and he saw the rest of the world, Paris and London, and he got a little adventure from that. But then he came back, and he moved to Kansas City, and he wanted to be a political cartoonist. I'm not making that up. And every newspaper turned him down. That was his goal in life, was to be a political cartoonist. And so he went to a library and he checked out a book on animation, which had just started becoming a thing. And he opened up a studio in Kansas City. So I went there, and the building is still there. and they're trying to bring it back as a museum. They still haven't gotten a museum point, but that's where he began. And so I researched that and Missouri and Chicago, and then, of course, it led me to California, where he eventually wound up in 1923. So researching Disney, a lot of it is hands-on, and, you know, there's nothing like going to the place where the person lived and things that they touched and things they – seeing it through their eyes, you understand them a little bit more.
Chris, have you visited the Disney parks in Florida and California? And if so, which one did you like better?
That's a very good – I've been to both, and it's like asking me to choose between my children because they're both – you know, the one in California I love because it was his park. He never saw the one – he died before Florida was built. So that was the one that he was in almost every day, and he loved it, and, you know, everything there still reeks of Walt. But the one in Florida – was his vision that he never got to accomplish, but his brother saw it through. So both of them have their charms, but if anybody's ever been to the two, you know, when you get East Coast people that finally go out to Disneyland, they're shocked at how tiny it is. I mean, it's Manhattan Island is bigger than Disneyland, so it's a very small area, and, you know, they're able to do all of that in that little tiny area. But Walt Disney World, by the sheer size of it, there's just so much to see and do. So I like both, but being an East Coast guy, you know, I'm in Florida a little bit more than California.
Okay, we're talking with Disney historian and author Chris Lucas. Chris, I was a huge Walt Disney fan myself growing up, watching Walt Disney Presents, the Mickey Mouse Club, and even Zorro religiously. And I guess you were the same way, hooked on Disney early, right?
I was, yeah. And you know, I was born in the late 60s, so Walt had died before I was born, but NBC kept rerunning his show on Sunday nights with him as the host and all that. So, you know, to my generation growing up, he was still around. We didn't know, and it wasn't until the 80s when they kind of NBC canceled the show that then he stopped becoming a personality. But for everybody that grew up watching that show, you know, he was, as he called himself, Uncle Walt. He never liked people calling him Mr. Disney. So we all, he was one of those TV personalities that people talk about, like, you know, Captain Kangaroo or Mr. Rogers just felt so warm and inviting, and I think that's part of what made so many people Disney fans too, was he was the one drawing us into that.
I think Walter Cronkite was the same way. People refer to him as Uncle Walter throughout his life. And you're listening
and
to Travelitch Radio with Dan Schlossberg and Mary Ellen Nugent-Lee. We're on iTunes, blogtalkradio.com, and Facebook. Check out the archive show at your convenience. And we're talking with Disney historian and author Chris Lucas.
Chris, you have two sons, one who just turned 17. Do your sons share your interests in all things Disney? And did they accompany you on your recent Midwestern jaunt?
They didn't come with me on the recent Midwestern one, but they do share my love for all things Disney. And I promised them one day we'll take a vacation that doesn't involve Disney somehow. You know, they've been along with that, but they love Disney, which is good. My oldest son is a film major, so he's gone with me to California, and there are a couple of places there. Like Walt Disney founded a college called Cal Arts, the California Institute of the Arts. That it was his idea to teach young animators, and so many Disney animators went there. And then it expanded to film and acting and everything, and there's lots of notable graduates, but that was his college that he founded. So we went there, and my son enjoyed that, and we went to the studios, of course, which are still around, and you mentioned Zorro. They tore down all the old lots, but they still have Zorro Street and the water tower and all these things. And there was a restaurant right near the studio called the Tam O'Shanter, which is sort of Scottish, as you imagine by the name. But Walt Disney ate there almost every day, and his table is still there. You can sit down. They have a photo of him sitting at the – so if a Disney fan is in California and they're done with the parks and looking for other things to do, you know, you can go there. And then Griffith Park, which is right near the studio – they have – the carousel is still there, and Walt Disney used to sit there with his daughters and watch them ride, and he got bored, and he thought, what if there was a park that everybody can go to and have fun together, and sort of got to Disneyland. But his barn in his backyard that he built to replicate the one in Marceline, they moved it to Griffith Park, and it's the only free Disney attraction in the world that's open one Sunday a month, and you can go in there. He built the barn himself, and all of his tools and his work clothes are in there, and it's one place where you can go and touch things and feel things that Walt himself, you can't even do that at the Disney park. So there's lots of things there that for my son, who's a film major and a Disney fan, you know, he loved doing that as much as I did, which is good. And my youngest is, he's into computers, but thankfully Disney's got a lot for that too.
Oh, you must have had a hard time. How did you decide which Disney things to put into the book and which to leave out?
It was very hard. It's funny because by accident, I wrote the 10 greatest classic Disney attractions. One of the things I did in the book, I made a line of classic and modern. And the classic was 1923, when Disney started, up until 1988, which was the end of their classic age, and before Michael Eisner and The Little Mermaid and all that stuff that kind of took us into where we are now. So 1989 on was the modern era, and before that was classic. So for the parks, I was trying to come up with 10 classic Disney attractions, and I put out the 10, and then in a special box, I put It's a Small World. I didn't have it listed in the top 10. I'm not a big fan of It's a Small World because the song drives me nuts sitting there for 20 minutes listening to it over and over again. And I shouldn't say that as a Disney fan, but a lot of people agree with me. So I didn't put it in the top 10, but I had a special box, and my publisher and my editor, for some reason, I didn't even notice it, we forgot to put that box in there. And it went to print, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, I'm going to get so much hate mail from Disney fans that love It's a Small World, and they're going to say, how could you not put it in the top 10? And thousands of people have read it. Not one person so far has said to me, how could you leave out It's a Small World? So it was tough leaving things out, and there were some where people did get mad at me for leaving out their favorites, but I tried to do it as diplomatically and fairly as I could.
Do you have enough for a second edition or even a brand-new book?
Well, that's the great thing about Disney. It keeps growing. So we went to print in 2017, and that was before Disney Plus and before their new Star Wars park opened and all these other things. So there's so much more to add that, yeah, there would be a second version, but we'll wait a couple of years to give it a little distance before the first one.
Mm-hmm.
Top Disney was actually your second book, right, Chris? Tell us about Seeing Home, the book you did with your father, Ed Lucas.
Well, that was a labor of love. As you mentioned, it's my dad who, of the short thumbnail version, he was struck blind when he was 12 years old by a baseball, and he loved baseball. It was his passion, and he thought his life was over. He was 12 years old. It was 1951. People told him, you'll never do anything. You'll never accomplish anything. And my grandmother wrote to all these big stars like Joe DiMaggio and Jackie Robinson and Phil Rizzuto, and they became his friends, and they encouraged him to pursue and go to college and get a degree and, you know, try to become a broadcaster and a writer. And he did, and he's been doing it now for 65 years. He's won an Emmy Award. He's won a whole bunch of writing awards. And he's slowed down a little bit now because he's 82. But his story in 2015, you know, people have been asking him for years, but he honored me by asking me to write with him. And it was published, and it became a bestseller, and they're in talks of making it into a movie. So it's been a blessing to be able to share my father's life story with others while he's still around and be able to talk with other people, you know, with him. And so many people have told us how they're inspired. It's, you know, technically it's a baseball story, but it's more about overcoming obstacles. And if he can do it, then anyone can do it.
Well, I know your dad very well, and I've been very good friends with him since 1971. And I hear rumors that Seeing Home is going to be a 2022 movie. Are you going to be in it?
I would hope so, yeah. I mean, you know, like everything with movies, the process moves slow and Hollywood takes its time. But they're shooting for 2022, but given all that's happened, you know, it could be pushed back even more. But, yeah, I'm blessed to be able to be in it, I'd be very happy to be part of that.
Mm. We're talking with Disney historian and author Chris Lucas. Chris, didn't you also do several promotional book tours for Seeing Home? Where did you go for that?
I actually, it was funny, on the 10-state trip that I was doing for Top Disney, one of the states I was in was North Dakota, and they have a museum for Roger Maris there, who was a great player, broke Babe Ruth's record in 1961, and they reached out to me knowing I was coming to Fargo to do a Disney event and said, hey, would you stop by and, you know, talk about Seeing Home? So we did it at the Roger Maris Museum, and lots of Disney fans turned out, and Yankee fans turned out. I didn't know there were that many Yankee fans in North Dakota, but, you know, they all loved Roger Maris. So even to this day, I get calls for both, for Top Disney appearances and for Seeing Home. My dad, like I say, he's slowed down a little bit. He's not able to make as many public appearances, so I'm the face of him. As I always say when people, you know, are looking for my dad, I say, you expected Mickey Mantle, you got Mickey Mouse.
Speaking of Seeing Home, Chris, there's obviously a strong baseball connection with you. Both Mary Ellen and I are baseball fans, so we'd love to hear about your personal connection, which I understand centers around the New York Yankees.
It does, yeah. You know, growing up with my dad, we were at the ballpark all the time, and so You know, all those guys that played for the Yankees from my childhood in the 70s on they were all part of my life. And I always say it was going with my dad to Yankee Stadium, and Dan, you'll relate to this, and my dad would hold court with Phil Rizzuto at this table in the Yankee Stadium dining room, and it was like being on The Tonight Show, because you never knew who was going to be at that table with them, what celebrity was going to show up that day. So it was quite a fun life. And the stadium, I miss the old stadium, but in 2008, they hired me to be a guide in the old stadium for the YES Network, and I did a bunch of reports for that, and then continued it in 2009 for 2 years, and I wound up getting a ring for it, a World Series. I didn't do anything on the field to get that World Series ring, but I now am my dad has 10 World Series rings. I have one.
Well, since this is a travel show, Chris, could you share what it's like to be a tour guide in the New York City area?
Sure. I mean, I love giving tours of New York City. I always say that people ask me if my first love was Disney. It was actually New York City, and the two are connected because I saw Robin Hood, which I mentioned earlier, at Radio City Music Hall. It was my first movie, and that was my introduction to New York City and Radio City and Times Square and all that, and Disney and show business. So all of my interests kind of on that one day in November 1973 came through. But New York City, what I love about being a guide, it's never the same. I can bring people the same exact locations 2 days in a row, and the city is like an organism that changes every day. So it's a lot of fun, and it's slowed down a little bit, obviously, with everything that's gone on the last year, but it's picking up. Good news for anybody that's thinking about New York, or they hold a theater in their heart, that when Broadway comes back, that's going to really boost it, because Broadway is the engine that drives New York City, especially at nighttime. But I've gotten more and more requests for tours now, so thank goodness people are coming back. And the city will always be New York City, the city we all know and love.
Wow, that's great. And what kind of tours do you do? And do you feel like you're actually being an actor when you're in your role as a tour guide?
I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's exactly how people sometimes say, oh, you're an actor who does tour. And I'm like, no, when you're a tour guide, you are performing. You know, it may be an audience of two, could be an audience of 50. I do Holiday Lights bus tours where we run buses all Christmas long, Christmas season long. And it's a bus full of 50 or 60 people sometimes, and we take them around to all the sites. But every time I get a new bus full of people, it's a new audience. So it's sort of like stand-up comedy or acting. The script is in my head, but it changes from every, again, we can go down one street and suddenly I'm talking about this or that. So it is very much a performance. It's performance art is the best way to put it. And that's why I love giving tours. And I've given a variety, the Holiday Lights one. I've got Yankee tours. I do general New York City tours, Broadway tours, whatever comes up. And, tomorrow I'm actually doing a tour of the Brooklyn Botanic Garden, which is first time. They're in Coney Island. So it varies from week to week, day to day.
That is so great. We're talking with Disney historian, actor, and author Chris Lucas.
Chris, you mentioned a little while ago that Disney was fanatical about trains and railroads. My memory, if it's correct, there was a show that he did depicting his own backyard railroad. Am I correct?
Yes, you are correct. That's he had to get his wife's permission because she had a flower bed, but he wanted to build a model railroad that he could ride with all his kids and friends in his backyard. And so he did. He built a scale model railroad that was people could get on, and he recreated his barn from his hometown in his backyard. And that was there until when he died, the family sold it. And as I said, they moved that barn, and that railroad is now the public can ride it, and it's in Griffith Park. So that's why when you go to the parks, the railroads are a big part of it as well, and that's in the book too. You can see trains are what drove Walt Disney. He used to, as a kid, would go down for fun to the railroad track and just sit there all day and watch trains going back and forth.
Oh, he sounds like you, Dan.
Thinking about the monorail that goes right through the middle of the Contemporary Resort in Disney World, I wonder if his backyard train went through his barn, too.
It did, yeah. He purposely made it good. And what I started to say about his wife, he had to get her permission. He signed a contract with her to dig a tunnel under the flower bed because she didn't want him ruining it. So he literally had a lawyer come and draw up a whole contract because she sort of humored it. It was a married couple, and she gave in every once in a while and fought him on some things. But on that one, she was adamant she did not want him ruining her flower bed. So they had to get a legal contract for him to go underneath and make it go around her flowers.
Chris, you've mentioned a couple of times that you are an actor. Can you tell our listeners some of the shows you've been in?
Sure. I've done TV shows like 30 Rock. I played the character of young Jack Donaghy, was Alex, Eric Baldwin's character. So every time they flash back to him as a young man, it was me. I was on As the World Turns for a while and then One Life to Live. And then mostly a lot of what I do is voiceover. So I did the voice of a character in a game called Grand Theft Auto Vice City. And I played a character who was a congressman. He's now the president in the game. So he's kind of grown. It's been several games since. And there's a new one coming out in a couple of months. So it's been a lot of fun. So that I get, you know, kids coming up to. I've never played the games myself, but I'm on them. And people always, I get emails, you know, once a week. Hey, you're the president on that game. But
okay. Less than 4 minutes to go. Is there anything we haven't asked that you'd like to add?
You know, we were talking earlier about the places for people to go, so I mentioned a lot of them, but the one that I really want to bring up, aside from the one in Marceline, is in San Francisco. Walt's daughter owns a vineyard in the Napa Valley, and she took the Presidio, which is absolutely beautiful, has a view of the Golden Gate Bridge, and she has the Walt Disney Family Museum, which has all of his personal stuff. So the one in Marceline is great for his hometown growing up as a boy, but if you really want more about him, with an amazing view, the one in San Francisco. So those are the two places I'd highly recommend, was Marceline, Missouri, and San Francisco, California, if you really want to know more about Walt Disney.
Okay. How do Travel with Radio listeners find your writing and learn more about Disney sites and your work, Chris?
Sure. They can go to my website, which is topdisneybook.com, and there's information about the book, and there's a whole bunch of top 10 lists on there. And then they could also email me at mousetop10@gmail.com. And either way, you can get in touch with me either way.
Our special guest tonight has been Chris Lucas, actor, author, tour guide, and Disney historian. Thanks, Chris, for being our guest on Travel with Radio.
Thank you so much. It was an honor.
For us, too. And with baseball season almost to the Labor Day mile marker, why not learn about the game's history from an educational but entertaining source? It's my book, The New Baseball Bible, Notes, Nuggets, Lists, and Legends from a National Pastime. 480 pages for less than a sawbuck. It's both a coffee table book and a bathroom book. Read it backwards and still enjoy it. That's The New Baseball Bible with Mike Trout on the cover. Get it tonight on Amazon.com. And that's it for this edition of Travel It Radio. Next week, same time, same station, same writers, same announcers. We'll talk to another terrific author from the world of travel, Julie Valerie. Now, this is Dan Schlossberg, along with my beautiful and talented co-host, Mary Ellen Nugent-Lee, saying thank you for your time this time. Until next time, good night and stay safe.